Bee Therapy, conversations about bees with Patrice Newell and Danny Lloyd-Pritchard. Bee buddy Danny, it's good to see you again.
It's great to see you too, Patrice.
Now, beekeepers, let's start off with our quiz question. Why do beekeepers use a smoker and what do they burn in it?
It's a great question, worthy of a lot of discussion.
Now, we talk about books, we've talked about movies, but we haven't talked very often about all the research papers that come our way that we read relating to bees and honey. So we're going to tackle that this time because we've read this fabulous paper. It's not a new one. It came out in 2011 and it's called The Collective Personalities in Honeybee Colonies Are Linked to Colony Fitness. It's published in Animal Behaviour, edition 81, and it's by Margaret Ray, that's spelled W-R-A-Y, Heather Mattia and the famous Thomas D. Seeley. He's a bit of the grand fromage in bee research and he's plenty of books and we're certain to be talking about work by Thomas D. Seeley in the future. But it really was a fabulous research paper, wasn't it, Danny?
It was. I loved it. I'm fascinated by bee researchers and in particular this one because of the focus of the paper, looking at personalities of bee colonies.
We all know, I suppose, in our vague way, that they're all unique, but somehow trying to work out a method and a system to really see what those differences are and give measurement to it, no small feat. Let's start by what they actually had to do to sort of get started with the research, because they did it in 2009 or 2009 in May. So that's in the United States. May is good May, June, July, August, sort of honey bee time. But they created 25 artificial swarms from genetically unrelated colonies with naturally mated queens. Mm. Now, they transferred a kg of workers, so that's about 7,500 bees, into the hives. They were put into Langstroth hives, mm-hmm. So the regular type of hive box that we use. They fed them sugar. Mm-hmm. To set them off, and they treated them for varroa mite. So they use a chemical there, Apistan, and that was for varroa mite and also for American fowl breed.
Yeah. So a little bit different to Australian techniques because we don't have to treat for varroa mite and we certainly don't treat for American fowl brood. It's resistant to antibiotics. So, yeah, slightly different approach to the research, but certainly very applicable in what they were studying and the outcomes of this research.
So when they're looking at personalities, they didn't just go with one characteristic of the personality. They were looking at defensive responses, their foraging activity, the diversity of pollen, all the different kinds that they get, their ability to repair comb. And the other thing that they refer to is runniness, which I use nervousness.
Yes, I use raciness. Yeah. How fast are those bees running around on the comb?
So the general rule is that if they're running really quickly, that's a negative. Mm. They're trying to work out if they're calm and less nervous. Mm. The undertaking component, how quickly do the bees remove any dead bees in the hive? So their hygienic behaviour. So quite, it's not like a simple thing. There's quite a lot that they're going over. They did it all in 5 weeks.
Yeah.
That was another thing. So it's a lot to take on board for the 5 weeks. They had to open the hives a lot.
They did. A lot of disturbance to these hives. But they were doing it consistently across all of them. So each hive was exposed to the same variables. So they tried to keep it as consistent as possible and measuring the same things at the same time.
Such as the foraging activities. So they'd check at 8:30 in the morning, then at midday, and then in the evening. And they were observing the bees leaving and entering.
Yes.
So they're doing that each day. I particularly like the pollen diversity. So they wanted to know, were they capturing all the different pollen that was available in the vicinity? And so they would capture approximately 30 returning pollen foragers from each colony. So there's 25 colonies. So they're getting 30 from each colony. And then they were counting how many different colours of pollen they carried.
But, and remember, they were trying to look for differences between the hive. They were trying to see, is that a personality trait of a colony in what pollens they actually forage for? And I think in the end, they didn't see any significant difference between the colonies.
But they spent a lot of time trying to work that out.
They did.
And people had two teams in a way, because they had to separate the pollen into the different groups. So there is a pollen colour chart, and they were trying to work out what each colour was. And then once they did a group, then a second group would, if there's any disagreement, then another group would sort of come in, and sometimes they'd have to join the colours together. Because when it comes to pollen colour, it is as complicated as a paint chart today, you know, 500 shades of white.
I liked when they were looking at the raciness of the hive, the runniness of the hive. So they had to pull a frame of bees out of every colony. They had to place it on a stand in front of a video camera, and they recorded the activity of the bees in a 10 by 10 centimetre square space. And they recorded for 2 minutes. But at the 1 minute mark, they dropped a 2 kilogram brick onto the top of the frame. So they gave it a disturbance. And they wanted to see how responsive the bees were and how different the raciness was after the disturbance. So, yeah, very interesting techniques and, you know, the life of a bee researcher.
Hey, what did you do during summer?
I videoed bees and I dropped bricks on their frame. Yeah.
The ability, well, their undertaking ability, how are they going to get the dead bees? They have to put dead bees in the hive to observe how the dead bees are being removed and how quickly they're being removed. So they had to obtain dead bees. So at another hive, at a different colony, a couple of days previously, they have to get the bees, 0.3 of a kg of bees, kill them, anaesthetise them with CO2, and then freeze them for at least 24 hours. And then the next day, they got the dead bees out from the freezer, and they marked each bee's thorax with paint, and then each of the 25 boxes got 100 dead bees in the bottom of the, on the bottom board.
It's a scientific, rigorous process.
That is a lot of bee handling when you think about it. And then, of course, they wanted to check how many came out.
Yeah. So they'd count the bees the next day, how many of the marked dead bees were left in those colonies. So hygienic behaviour is an important trait and something that in Australia we're certainly looking at, because when we do get varroa, we don't want
it. You say that. Why do we have to say that?
Because it's a given. They're basically saying it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when we get varroa on our shores. We're the last country in the world that doesn't have this varroa mite. But anyway, that's another story. Getting back to the hygienic behaviour, studies have shown that the more hygienic a hive is, the more able they are to control varroa mite numbers in their hive. So it's seen as a strength in a trait of a beehive. So that's why they would have been looking at this particular behaviour in these colonies.
This undertaking also relates a little bit to comb repair.
Mm-hmm.
They're repairing.
And they did measure that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they cut a dirty big hole in a frame and watched how quickly they repaired it.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty brutal, a lot of this, isn't it? Really, when you think about it, it's not a little bit, perhaps not kind to the bees.
No, it was hardcore science.
I think when you think of a bee and the size of a bee, it is remarkable. Well, all these bee researchers must have very good eyesight.
Yes.
Nimble fingers, determination and patience.
Mm-hmm. And tolerance to stings.
Probably
occupational hazard.
Probably that too. In the end, they worked out that there were personality traits that were marked differences.
I think they confirmed what beekeepers already know. Colonies do have distinct individual characters or temperaments. What about your hives? Have you noticed that?
Absolutely, I would say. It's like all your children are unique. and if you think of a hive as a super organism.
Yes. So it's a collective intelligence. It's a collective personality.
And I would definitely say that. And I know you're not meant to prefer any of your children over the other, but I tend to be drawn to some hives more than others.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm thinking. Sometimes I'll find myself that I've been thinking about a particular hive.
Hmm.
quite a lot.
So tell me about the personality traits of your favourite hives.
Well, I probably wouldn't have thought the nerviness or the raciness or the runniness, as they did in the research paper, refer to it as a negative, because my toughest hive, my favourite hive, is really quite aggressive. Mm-hmm. But it is, being with me now, it's naturally requeened. Mm-hmm. It's very tough, mm-hmm. and it is a great provider. And so I regard it as strong and healthy, and I love it because of that.
Okay, so your hives are located in a rural area. You don't have neighbours within 10 metres of your hive, so to speak.
No.
So I have had a similar hive, very productive, but extremely defensive, to the point that my neighbours were getting stung, you know, 20 metres away from the hive. They only had to come out of their house and there was a bee buzzing and harassing them. So in urban areas, that kind of hive with those traits is not favourable for your neighbours. And I've had to requeen a colony like that to a more docile, it was productive, but it was docile type of queen.
Because I don't keep bees in an urban area, do you, if your neighbour got stung, where does that put you in a, is it like having an animal, a dog who attacked your neighbour?
Well,
where does the bee fit in?
It would be difficult to prove it was my bee because there are a lot of bees out there. But I do go in very apologetic, and I've given away lots of jars of honey to my neighbours to keep the deal sweet. But if I know that my neighbours are having a serious problem with the bees, I don't want nuisance beehives
Absolutely.
Around, and I'll remove them. So far, fingers crossed, we've been able to deal with any of the situations that arose, and I manage my hives better now. You do have to requeen. It's important when you've got defensive hives in urban areas.
Yep. We will, in a later date, talk about the requeening.
We will. Let's finish up with this paper, though, because overall, what do you think they found? I think they confirmed that there definitely is personality differences between colonies, and they found a couple of correlations which were really interesting, which you've just confirmed. You said your best hive, your most productive, strong hive is defensive. And so overall they found that foraging and defensiveness was correlated, the runniness, the raciness and defensiveness was correlated, and the more foraging and the more defensive a colony was, the greater its survival through winter. So the fitness was greater with the defensiveness. Yeah.
Suggesting if you keep making them too docile and too calm,
we may be weakening the race.
It's a control mechanism, a human control mechanism, and we're not letting the bee have its full expression.
Correct.
Well done, Margaret Ray, Heather Mattia and Thomas Seeley.
Fascinating research. I love it. Patrice, I've been cooking again.
I'm glad to hear it.
It's roasted sweet potatoes with honey and butter with a pinch of cinnamon. Have you ever tried it?
Well, I certainly try sweet potato many, many times. Yes, I love putting honey on it. The depth of flavour is often dependent on how I cut the sweet potato.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the quality of the sweet potato, but how I cut them, big or small. And I generally peel them and slice them. So I have rounds. That would be my main thing. I usually just lay them out on a tray, melt a bit of honey with olive oil and baste it over the top. Mm-hmm. Generally, that's the way I do it.
Okay.
What about you?
I dice them, peel them and dice them, and then I mix my melted butter or oil with honey, put it into a Ziploc bag, throw my diced sweet potatoes into the bag, shake it all up, make sure there's a bit of cinnamon and a bit of salt in there, and then I tip it out onto my baking sheet and into the oven to roast for about half an hour.
You can't go wrong with that. I recently, because sweet potato or pumpkin, if I want a yellow vegetable, starchy one, my latest favourite is honey and miso.
Oh, yeah.
And that works on the sweet potato but also on the pumpkin. Mm. And if I have, what are the small ones called?
Butternuts?
A butternut, thank you very much. Having a moment there, slice the butternut lengthways, peel, and then maybe a few gashes along the top where you can, with a basting brush, put the miso honey based along the top so that you get quite a little crispy miso honey coating on it.
Yum.
But that works with the sweet potato and it works with the pumpkin. Yeah. So that is certainly my latest favourite.
It's interesting. I grew up with honey roasted carrots. Or I think my mum used to, all the vegetables were boiled. My nan used to do the same, boiled the vegetables to death. But with carrots, they'd boil them with honey. And then my mum got into roasting, and so she'd always put a drizzle of honey over the top of the carrots as they were roasting, and that's delicious as well.
Did your mum put the honey in the boiling water because she was trying to make the carrots sweeter? Like, were the carrots, because sometimes you can get carrots and they're not very sweet. They can be woody. Do you think she was doing it to try and enhance the flavour of a pretty average carrot?
Could have been, but at that stage she was going through a creative spurt in her cooking, and I think she was trying to be exotic.
So putting honey in water is exotic?
It was back then.
Haven't we come a long way in the kitchens of Australia, though, really?
Oh, we have. We have the flavours that we have now and the combinations. It's so cultural. I love it.
Yeah. Okay, let's get back to our question. Mm. Why do beekeepers use a smoker and what do they burn? Mm. Do you always use a smoker?
I do, except if it's a total fire ban. So there are exceptions to the rule. And on those days, if I've had to do a quick check of the hive or maybe I was, you know, placing some food or something into the hive, I would use sugar water in a spray bottle or just plain water. But, yeah, I always have a smoker lit and I always take it with me to the hive. I try to use the least amount of smoke as possible because the idea behind using a smoker for a beekeeper is to really mask the smell of any attack pheromones that the bees may have released when you opened up the hive. And by masking that smell, they're less likely to come out. They'll lose that urge to attack you as a beekeeper. So it keeps the bees docile.
I think every time I check queens, they would be the times that I would always make sure I go to the hive with she-oak needles.
Okay.
But I also gather lawnmower clippings off the lawn, just grass clippings, which can be really nice and light, and start with a little bit of newspaper. Too, to get them going. I always remember at Tokar when we were being judged on our smoker use, how everyone was a total nervous wreck because, you know, here we are being observed in our smoker skills and, of course, we do it all the time and then suddenly you cannot get it to smoke.
You're being assessed.
And you feel like a complete idiot. That was very funny. But, yeah, and I was very surprised then to learn that so many people use Hessian.
They do. A lot of my older beekeeping mentors always used Hessian because it was available. It was the
I was just going to say, as if it's easily available now.
It was easily available. Yeah. And it smoulders, it doesn't burn because it's made from hemp, a hemp fibre, which is a known fire retardant. So it is actually a fabulous fuel to put in a smoker. And for people that don't know what a smoker consists of, you've basically got a canister or a barrel, which is where the fuel goes in that you're burning. And at the back of that is some bellows, similar to what a forger would use in, you know, the old forge. And you're puffing the bellows to puff the air into that canister where the fuel's burning. And then the top of the canister is a little spout where the smoke comes out. And that's what you use to direct the smoke into the hive. And you don't use too much, though. You need to make sure that smoke is cool, not hot. So there is a real technique
Absolutely.
To it. People laugh and go, oh, smoker, that would be so easy. It's not, and it's one of the most essential tools for a beekeeper, and you have to know how to light it, how to keep it alight, and how to use
That's the
it
trick.
Effectively. Too hot, you're going to burn the bees, and they're not going to be calm. They're not going to go down into the hive, which is kind of what you're trying to do, to push them down so you can work the frames easily with less bees around. It's going to send them racing and it's going to send them jumping up at you and the buzz of the hive will just increase. They won't be happy.
That tonal range of the hive, but because often people say, oh, can I come with you to look at your hive? Clearly those people, their first task is to help manage the smoker.
Oh, that's a big job.
Yeah, and you tell a lot about your comrades at the hive when they go puff, 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 puff.
Yes.
The more nervous they're getting. Puff, 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 puff.
They're surrounded by this cloud of smoke and none of it's gone on the bees.
Or, and then we suddenly, we put it down and we're looking in the hive and then, of course, there's been no puff, puff and it's gone out.
And it's gone out. Or sometimes it's happened, they've put the smoker down on some combustible dry fuel.
Oh, we wouldn't do that.
Oh, it happens. There's quite a few bushfires have been started from apiary sites, I can tell you. So, you know, it becomes quite hot. So you have to be conscious of where that smoker is all the time, and you have to keep it handy and keep puffing it every so often to ensure that you're getting that smoke generating and not fizzling out. You may need to pop the lid and give it a bit of a stir or add a little bit more fuel to it. But I use pine needles. So similar to you, it's one of the traditional fuels. It does produce a cool smoke and lots of it, and they just smoulder for a long time. I've also tried cardboard, and recently I heard of people rolling out egg cartons, rolling them flat and then rolling them tight into like a scroll and putting three or four scrolls into their smoker and lighting that up. They swear by it. They said it just
I think we could all do that.
We could try it.
It's funny. I would have thought there'd be too many glues in that material.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I wouldn't.
You want to be careful what you're burning. You know, you don't want to burn anything that has chemicals in it or paint. So I know some people like to use wood shavings, but wood shavings could be treated as well. You've got to make sure it hasn't come from treated pine or something like that. And yeah, just newspapers or magazines. Again, there's a lot of inks on that, so just be careful. I think keeping it to natural fibres is the best. And pine needles, traditionally, they're the most commonly used fuel. It does create a resin that builds up inside your smoker, but that's good because my smokers are quite old now. My first smoker's over 12 years old. It's coated in this thick layer of black resin.
But you chip it off.
Oh, you could, but there's no point. It actually.
But sometimes
it
makes
it insulated.
Yes, but it also keeps the hole where the smoke comes out. I clear that.
You do need to keep checking your smoker. Make sure the bellows aren't split. Make sure there's no holes in it where flames and sparks can come out.
Yeah. I'd say the other most important reason why I have to have the smoker with me at all times is because I'm always cleaning my hive tool in the smoker.
Ah, that's good. Between your hives.
Absolutely. Always. Yeah. So I now always have two or three hive tools because you obviously you're making it hot when you're sticking it in your smoker.
Yeah.
But having that heat to kill any potential disease that you may not have seen but could be hiding
just
in there.
Just burn it off. Yeah. Some of the diseases will respond to that heat. Fortunately, American fowl brood won't, but it's always good to, between your hives, to clean your tools. And if you had one for each hive, that would be perfect.
No.
I always have a bucket of water with me because you can drop a smoker and, you know, it doesn't take long for a situation to build where you've created a little fire around your feet.
I always carry mine now in a metal bucket.
Good.
So the metal bucket, I'm lifting the metal bucket up and it's always sitting in that.
Yeah, my son made me a little fireproof carry case for my smoker, but I've also used, I think it's an ammunition from the army disposal stores. They've got ammunition cases and you can get some at the perfect size to fit your smoker in. If you're traveling between beehive sites.
Does that have a nice handle on it? I think you have to take a photo of
that. It's in army green.
Is that, I don't know, a more of a fashion item for the beekeeper than, say, my metal bucket?
Possibly. Okay. It looks like, you know, I've got this camo gear. It looks like I'm going out shooting, not beekeeping.
Danny, beekeeper stroke hunter. Okay. Yeah. All right, Danny, great talking.
Yeah.
Until next time.
Yeah, see you then, Patrice.
Bye.